This is a Glass Box Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Blank Podcast, the podcast where we do something and talk to people about blank stuff, and then they tell us about their blank moments. So good that I've done the intro this week. You'll find out why later on in this episode, why I'm doing the intro and not Giles. There's normally smooth intro, and it was me instead this week. But I am Jim Daly, and joining me, of course, Giles Paley Phillips. Hello to you. How was that experience of not being the intro man?
When I sort of started to, because we can see each other obviously on Zoom, I started to wander away from the microphone and started pointing at you. I think you were like, "Oh shit, I've got to do the intro."
I'd forgotten.
Then froze and actually went blank. I think you went blank in that moment.
Earliest blank moment on the podcast,
possibly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So well done. Well done for keeping it on brand.
What we should have done is taken the advice of this week's guest, Callie Beaton, the wonderful Callie Beaton, and got you to actually write down what the intro was. But I'd forgotten until that moment when the music sting was playing that I was doing the intro this week.
Yeah.
But anyway.
I was going to say, sometimes it's better to sort of... Well, I'm going to say sometimes it's better to wing it, but obviously clearly you've shown that it's not always as good to wing it. But I think sometimes when it's written down, there's more pressure in a way. Like when we have to do like ads and stuff... We have to recall it several times, don't we? Because we always fuck it up.
Not always. We've got better. We've got a lot better.
Well, I always fuck it up.
But I do think you read things differently written down than I think when if they come out of your head, definitely. But anyway, the reason that I was doing it this week is something we talked about with Callie on this week's episode of changing the roles and getting me to do it. And I think it's safe to say that I won't be doing it again for some time. No, it was quite fun. Does that mean you're going to do the outro for start the outro then? And you got to introduce the guests as well.
Yeah, I know. So I've got this pressure on me now.
There we go.
Now I'm starting to get a bit nervous. perspiring a little bit now.
Before we get into the pressure moments, how are you doing? How's your week been?
Good, yeah, busy. Busy, busy, busy. Although I find myself, because I often go down to Backers Coffee Shop, as with the famous Backers, in the mornings, and that's kind of how I often start my day, and I tend to do like emails and stuff down there, but I often get talking to people, and I think a lot of people don't think I do any work because I'm often in Backers talking to people,
chatting away.
But I do genuinely have lots of things going on. I am actually employed to do lots of stuff. So if anyone's listening and they go to Backers and they see me in there, I am working,
right?
As much as I am also enjoying myself.
Just want to set that record straight.
Yeah, because I think, there might be rumours going around that I don't do anything.
Maybe. And there's no smoke without fire.
Indeed.
Listen, let's introduce this week's guest. It's the fantastic comedian, Callie Beaton. You may have seen her on QI. You may have seen her on Pointless. You may have seen her at the Edinburgh Fringe doing a run of 4-star shows. Fantastic comedian.
You might have seen her doing a corporate gig.
You might have seen her doing corporate or doing lots of public speaking gigs. It's very prolific, absolutely fantastic person, very easy to chat to. And we had a really, really interesting conversation it went to all different places, didn't it?
It did. And actually, if you Google Callie Beaton, it'll come up as orator.
Oh.
Yeah. So it doesn't come up as comedian it comes up as orator.
Could we be, you and I be, put ourselves down as orators, seeing as we do a podcast?
Well, what I was going to say was perfect for Callie because she is very good at speaking and obviously very good at public speaking. I would not be very good at public speaking. So I don't think I would class myself as an orator.
But a podcaster is an orator, surely.
Well, we're just hosts, aren't we? I think hosting's slightly different. We're presenters, I guess, aren't we?
Yeah. We should say as well that Callie also has an excellent podcast,
she
Namaste.
Does.
Namaste, motherfucker.
Brilliant guests on the other week, weren't there?
So great guests last week. Two orators from the podcast world, actually.
Or presenters.
So do check that out. There'll be a link below so you can check that out as well. And fascinating person. Great story about how she got into stand-up. Some great name dropping. I mean, honestly, this episode's got everything.
Oh, no, it was a brilliant episode. And Kylie was very candid about actually that brilliant story that a lot of people know about her getting into comedy. I won't give anything away, no plot spoilers. But there actually was a more challenging part of that as well. It wasn't just this sort of amazing kind of eureka moment. It was there was a challenging part of that. And we talked a lot about the menopause, women getting into their late 40s, early 50s, and having that, or pre-menopause actually, where it can be quite challenging mental health-wise. Mm-hmm. And there's some stark statistics out there regarding, you know, like relationship breakdowns and things like that, and also having very severe mental health issues, and sometimes suicide rates are very high in that age. So stuff that we'd never talked about in the pod before, and I think, you know, I think a lot of people listening it might be the first time they've heard about it, or will have that knowledge about the menopause and those moments in life. And it was really great that Callie felt comfortable to talk about that stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, probably a subject that doesn't get brought up very often on a podcast hosted by two blokes.
Well, no, and that's good that it was, because, you know, I think you and I learned a lot of stuff as well.
Absolutely. And that is basically the aim of podcasts, isn't it? For everyone to try and learn something, especially us, especially you and me. You know, I think that's very important. So, yeah, Callie raised some really important issues, but was also just a fantastic guest to talk to, and just incredibly funny, very easy to talk to. And it's a lot of fun this episode. So would you, Giles, like to do the honours of introducing the guest?
Yes, on this week's podcast, it's Callie Beaton on the Blank Podcast. I said podcast twice.
I liked it.
That's rubbish.
It's fine, and he couldn't be more laid back, but I'm trying to sort of do the, and then occasionally my actual children want some parenting and I get very resentful.
How dare you?
You've been calling me.
Yeah, well, I'm a bit like that with our cat. I'm like, oh, you know, the cat needs feeding and stroking and looking after, but I've had a really bad day at school. Come on. The cat's not had 16 hours sleep today.
Yeah, that's true. I know, it's funny, isn't it? My kids did say to me last week, they were like, is he your favorite child? I was like, yeah.
Honesty is the best policy.
Yeah.
Exactly. Your podcast, by the way, is lovely. The one, as in yours, is lovely that I'm on now. Oh, right, yeah. But your podcast is lovely.
Thank you.
But my podcast with you on it was a particularly lovely episode. We've already had some really nice feedback.
Thank you for having us on. We very much appreciated it.
Yeah, it was really, really nice. And you literally, as I said, the perfect guest.
Well, that's really cool. That's nice.
Look at us. I know. What a loving. It's going to go downhill. It's like the beginning of a relationship. We're all like, I really fancy you and you don't annoy me at all.
We like the same things. We like all the same things.
It's uncanny. We finish each other's sentences.
I guess, Giles, maybe you not, because I've only been with Michelle for a long time, but like, Callie, have you been on a date where you've like massively lied about something that the other person's into just to seem on their wavelength?
I mean, I 100% will have done, because I've been on so many dates that, you know, you just name a scenario and I'll be like, I did that.
It's like an improv game.
So there will be, I can't think of a specific one, I am really into music, and often the start of a relationship, you know, when you're sending like playlists back and forth to each other.
Oh, it used to be mixtapes.
I know, and now
there was effort put in.
There's still effort put in, but it's different effort. But the people I date are usually so old, they were like scratching out vinyl. But but I've definitely done that where I've, you know, you're talking about music and there's definitely common ground, and then they talk about a band they absolutely love and you don't want to go like, fucking hate them. So you're like, and then next thing you know, they put tickets and you're
I've got to go and watch it now.
I definitely, my last serious relationship, he was mad into music, and I'd say there was an 80% overlap on our Venn diagram, but the 20% that wasn't was diabolical. But in the beginning, I tolerated it way too much, and I did get dragged to all kinds of shit music.
Okay, Can you reveal any of these?
I feel really bad because they're not big bands, and I'm like, it's not fair for me. I mean, they're big in that, you know, they're big enough to be selling decent venues, I feel really bad punching down to bands that aren't massively mainstream. And I kind of respected that he at nearly 60 was still going to that stuff.
Yeah,
to be fair, the only people going to it were men who were nearly 60. So yeah, I've definitely lied about musical taste, and we all lie a bit, don't we? Not lie, you know, that bit, I know for you two it's longer ago, but at the beginning of a relationship and you just bring out the best in each other and it's like, oh my god, I'm so my best self with you, and it's kind of effortless.
Yeah.
And you suddenly are totally laid back about whether they've booked somewhere for dinner, and you know, if they leave all their stuff on the floor and piss on the toilet seat, you're like, I just love the way you do that.
Yeah.
And then within 6 months you're like, I fucking hate you. And if you do
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true.
It's like false tolerance. And then and they think, they're like, you're so chilled. My last girlfriend wasn't at all chilled. And 6 months in, they're like, it's like being in prison, Kelly.
Yeah. It's interesting you saying about that thing about what you're saying about on dates and stuff, though, because I think Nick Hornby in High Fidelity wrote something like, it's not what you are like, it's what you like. So you kind of, you kind of find those common grounds with people on the stuff that you like together, you know, those sort of things like music and food and all those kind of stuff. But it's not, you don't kind of portray what you're like as a person, particularly at the beginning. It's more about those common grounds that you can start to find, I suppose you start to caress a relationship, but then then later you start to find out what people are like as opposed to what they like.
Yeah, I love that book. Thank you for even mentioning. I haven't thought about that book in years. And I mean, I love Nick Hornby, but that book, superb book. It's funny, isn't it, how you, I'm going straight in deep here.
But no,
I will reveal that I'm sort of fairly newly in what I think is going to be a lovely relationship. You know, 6 hours in, guys, it's going really well. So he's just in the other room. But the thing that drew me to him, interestingly, was actually something quite deep, we were chatting about other things. We definitely got lots in common and loads of kind of good banter, people in common. But then he started talking about his middle kid, who's got quite significant special needs. She's got a quite rare genetic birth disorder. And she's now nearly 20. And he said to me, like, a couple of weeks in, he said, I fancied you the minute you walked in. You know, when did you fancy me? I said, I know this can sound really weird, but when you start talking about fathering your middle child, I said, I just found that, like, massively, I don't mean massively hot. I wasn't like, oh, you know, fuck me now. I'd say that on your podcast.
No, you can.
It was more, I think, probably being a 53-year-old out dating with a kid with special needs. The fact that there was a kind of proper grown-up going, this happened, this is what, he wasn't talking about it in a braggy way, but I just loved everything about how he'd handled it and how he talked about it. And I was like, that's it now. Total head over heels. You could not be more alluring to me. So yeah, isn't that, and I did say to him, if this ends up being a real thing, you can tell your daughter she was the gateway.
Well, you kind of, you're like, oh, okay, this person's an adult. That's great. I can deal with them. They're not a child. Because even if you're 60, 50, you can still be quite childlike. So it's nice to be able to, like, I guess you kind of saw those deeper things within that person that, you know, they've got compassion and empathy. And
it's that, you know, and he is actually, we're both complete dickheads and still think we're 25, which is also reassuring. But it was just nice to know that accompanying that was that capacity. And I think you learn a lot. I guess that was me hearing him say something about one of life's most challenging situations without saying, here's how I handled it. Yeah. That was how he handled it.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it was about it that really made me sit up and listen. So I think he was hoping I was going to say, oh my God, yeah, you've got such a nice ass. And I was just looking at your eyes and thinking, oh, I wouldn't mind. I was like, I just love the fact you have a special needs child that you look after really well.
I think when it comes to family, I don't think people can lie in a way. I think the way people talk about their family, I think, is one of the most honest moments, I think, in life anywhere. And I think you can, and Giles is right about the early days when you're pretending to be into stuff or things you like and stuff. But people do show you, I think, little moments of themselves. And clearly he did at that moment, talking about something that's always, everyone's family is important to them. It's always going to be, that's always going to be a real moment, I think, talking about your family.
Yeah, definitely. And I think inevitably, we talked, didn't we, on my podcast about dating, and you guys said, oh, have you ever met anyone off the internet, meaning each other for the podcast? I was like, have I? and then went on to a whole thing about online dating. But because I date mainly, I have found that dating people with children is quite helpful when you have children, because as you guys know, not that you've been out the other side, and hopefully you won't be, of dating as guys with kids, but actually, when you've had kids, it's not that people who haven't had kids would be amazing people to meet and to date, but there's so much you need to understand about the kids coming first that if you don't have a kid would probably be very annoying. But as soon as you've got a kid, so I absolutely understand any man I date's kids are coming first, and they hopefully would understand that. And so there's always a little bit in midlife dating, there's a bit of a finding out about their kids, not what their kids are doing, but just you get little hints about what you might, if they say my daughter's just got a pony, you're like, anyway, goodbye.
Yeah, yeah. Have a lovely life.
Yeah. It's been great. Enjoy the pony.
Exactly. Enjoy the pony. We could call this episode that. And everyone
we should do titles.
I know. It's funny, isn't it, when you go back, going to podcasts, actually thinking, oh, we should have done that, just made random titles.
It's too late now.
It does take time, because I have that on mine. Yeah. And I do intros, as you probably know, with like bits of trivia, and I have a title every time. And that, if it's a bad week and you're flat out, you're like, ugh, why didn't I just have to do the interview bit? Yeah. And then you guys obviously do a chat, but it without causing offence, it seems unscripted, your chat.
No.
Oh, good. That's the vibe we're going for. Thank God.
Imagine if we said otherwise now.
Oh, actually, no, it's very scripted.
I'd almost
go, it's like The Office then. It's like, really, it's so scripted, it's unscripted.
I do that with my Fiverr football podcast, and I do the same thing, the sort of random titles each week. And some weeks you're just scraping the barrel and you think, oh my. Some weeks I'm just like, football. I just look at all I can think of as a title, but it's, yeah.
Oh, well, I'm glad we didn't do that then.
Yeah. I Google songs and books. If I can't think of anything, I'll just think of the thing I'm roughly looking for, and then I'll just chuck in a... although I've realised that I called your episode Point Blank, and you'll be like, okay, Kelly, yeah, we see. We'll see what happened there.
Oh, here we go.
It was at 1 a.m. I was like, oh, shit.
I've been there many times. Yeah. Many times. Oh, I've got my phone.
Now, as is our 10th... Yeah, what are you doing?
I thought you were like... Yeah. I was like, wasn't that good at punchline?
It never is of me, guys.
As is our tendency on this, we always like to delve back into people's earlier lives. So am I right, you grew up in the West Country, Dorset area?
Dorset, yeah. I did. I was born in the home counties, but we moved to Dorset when I was 7. And I lived in Dorset until I was 16. And then I went to college in Wiltshire and then from there to London.
Very cosmopolitan. So,
yeah, 7 exactly. Although when you're 16 and you leave home to go to Salisbury, that's the big deal.
Great steeple there, apparently.
Amazing
Salisbury.
Steeple. Yeah, it is a cathedral city. Yeah. It's a cathedral. Ted Heath used to live on the cathedral coast.
Did he?
I know that because my then boyfriend got arrested because he climbed a tree to smoke some weed. I don't know why you'd climb a tree to smoke some weed, but we were in the cathedral coast smoking weed. He decided to climb a tree, fell into the garden of the house next to the tree, which happened to be Ted Heath's garden.
Oh my God.
To have police presence. So instead of just falling out of a tree and getting back out, he was arrested. So there you go. Wow. That's my story. I hope my mum and dad are listening to this and make you proud. My dad's a musician, and he quite often is in concerts at Salisbury Cathedral. So I'm sure he'll be ever so proud.
Yeah. Next time he'll think of very different things next time he's there.
His amazing daughter and her boyfriend.
So what was growing up in that area like? Were you quite rural? Was it quite rural where you were?
Well, I grew up in the grounds of a school. So my parents were teachers and they worked in prep schools.
Okay.
My mum was born a girl in a boys' school. So she was educated in an all boys prep school.
Okay.
And then my parents ended up doing exactly the same thing. So I was born in the grounds of a school, which I was too little to go to, and went to my local school in Buckinghamshire, which I love, just local primary school. A mix of, you know, both, as then was, both genders all represented. And then we moved to Dorset, and at 7, I started going to a boys' boarding school.
Right.
And we lived on the grounds of the boys' boarding school. So in answer to your question, I don't know if rural was the problem as much as everything else.
Yeah.
So, wow. There's no getting away there.
No. So that's...
Trapped.
Yeah, and actually I joke about it on stage and in corporates because I do a lot of after dinner speaking in quite male environments. And I also do a lot of speaking in, you know, industries like the gaming industry where people are trying to remove barriers to women becoming more influential in those industries. So I'm a passionate sort of, you know, I speak out about women and belonging and how we make space for women. But actually, so I often talk about that story, and then being the only female member of a, you know, of the ITV board is another story. That's one of the things that gets me booked for corporates. But actually, fundamentally, not belonging to that degree is not a great start in life. So I kind of semi-joke about it, but I think it's actually fairly detrimental.
Yeah, that must have been incredibly difficult to navigate through that.
Do you know, it's a funny thing because much as my kids have been state educated, I'm a, you know, a absolute kind of guardianista through and through. So I'm not a fan of the private education system. And as soon as I was able to be vocal about it, I got out of it as a pupil. Quite young, I kind of rebelled against it and didn't want to be there. My brother went right through the system and I was like, I don't want to keep in this system. But I will say that the prep school I went to, and this is the unfair thing, isn't it? It was an incredible school. It was very sort of liberal. Everybody got the opportunity to do everything from music to drama to whatever you could do. And I cannot dispute that those 5 years I was there, much as they were quite damaging in some ways, they probably did also enable me to do an enormous amount. And so I had enormous privilege, which is awful, isn't it, really? That is what private education buys you. And I can't deny that I was the beneficiary of that for those 5 years. I left when I was 13. So, yeah, so it's a bit of a double-edged sword, really. But suffice it to say, I wouldn't have sent my children to boarding school over my dead body. So.
It's funny you say privilege. Privilege is a funny thing. And again, without getting sort of too deep and stuff, like some people have it and some don't. And so it's often not your choice, I guess. Like, you know, you were just chucked into this system. But I think it's important that if you do have privilege like that, that you're sort of honest about it and open about it and talk about the fact that I did get a leg up or whatever.
And that not everyone does get that, right? Because I mean, the weird thing for us is we had no money. So teachers, my parents, just because they were private school teachers, they didn't earn more than state school teachers. So we had very, very little money. So we would be going on camping holidays or staying. And, you know, my mum's aunt had a little, very little basic kind of almost kind of no electricity level basic cottage in Cornwall that we'd go to. And I was going to school with like people from around the world who were children of royalty, literally children of royalty.
Wow. And why don't they get paid more? That's mad.
So we didn't.
I don't think it's much different now either.
I don't think it is.
You get a bit of extra holiday, but that's about it.
But not much, no, because my kid's stepmom is a teacher. But so we didn't have money. So I had privilege, but absolutely. So again, on another level, I was also completely an outsider because everybody was absolutely loaded. You know, I'd never been on a plane, never been anywhere glamorous, and lots of kind of quite famous people sent their kids there. I really did not fit in that way. So it's really weird, isn't it, to have this, I did have that privilege. It's funny, I'm doing something tomorrow. I'm facilitating a thing for a bank who shall remain nameless. And I'm always slightly like, before I do those corporates, I'm like, I just want to find out what this is and whether I ethically am in agreement with it. And it's a forum for children of very, very wealthy people, like top sort of 20 clients of this bank, to sort of help, because apparently they are a really vulnerable category, like people with that inherited wealth actually sometimes don't live. And when they said it, I did say, could you just let me know, are these all people who've just got family wealth, or might some of these be people whose parents won the lottery? And they said, no, it is not all people who've come from privilege, but it is all people whose parents now have great wealth. But then when they were talking about how they were going to run the day, they were talking about the opening. They said, what we think we should do is get everybody to get up and say who they are and what their ambitions are. I said, you know, that would be absolutely unfair on somebody who's maybe not at all confident as a public speaker, who probably would be standing up there next to someone who'd gone to Eton and has been debating since they were in short trousers. Yeah, yeah. So I just thought, you don't realise, and also the people on the call briefing me were quite, I would say, maybe quite privileged men. Yeah. And I just thought, you haven't even thought about the fact there'll be people in that room for whom this is terrifying and who feel desperately inadequate, that they're total imposters. So it's funny, isn't it? People, you don't sort of don't know what you don't know, really. But I straddled really weird sort of line of privilege, but definitely not much money and not thinking I should be there, really.
I was just thinking about that. So going back to what you just said about like people standing up and saying who they are and stuff. Would it not get into a bit of a like tit for tat of who's got the most money?
Yeah. Well, they don't
well actually,
the
mine's my dad's the king of Norway.
The Earl of yeah, yeah.
I don't think they were supposed to show their bank balance. But I do think some of these people apparently don't know how much money they're going to get. So like they know there's money.
And today we're going to reveal...
I think I said, why don't I run it as a game show?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what we'll do. Forget the well-being session. Yeah. Let's just film the fucking thing.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a great idea for a TV show, guys.
I want to make money off the back of these people. So this is how
it is. It's the big reveal. They've decided to disinherit you.
And I've slept with your stepdad. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the twist. Oh man, I mean that would actually do really well, but never mind.
It would actually. Let's pocket that one. Mm, I've got contacts in that industry.
Yeah, I was going to say this is good. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, we've got a sponsor. We'll make this happen.
Good brainstorming, guys.
No, so obviously you said you had sort of extracurricular stuff with the school. Was that a time where you got into kind of drama and stuff?
Tell you what, I did get into drama because I was much happier being not me. So obviously that was an easy way to not be me for a bit. But the thing I got massively into was music. So I played the piano from when I was quite little. My parents are quite musical and we had a piano and I used to sort of muck about on it from when I was tiny. But when I got to that school, I played the piano every spare hour of the day. I didn't at the time think why, but I now know why. It was because I had something to do where I didn't have to talk to anyone and be with anyone. And the piano is obviously a solo instrument. Interesting that I didn't pick an orchestral instrument. So I probably played the piano for 4 to 5 hours a day, every day, from 7 to 13. Wow. And there was a beautiful grand piano because it was an incredibly well-equipped school. There was a beautiful grand piano in this lovely auditorium. And so I used to play on a Beckstone grand piano. As a kid from a house without much money, that's what I could do every day. And I used to go in there and just play. And they used to let me unlock the hall to go in, lock the hall to go back. I was a boarder at the school for the last 2 years. And I'd go to my dormitory at the very last sort of bit. By then there were 8 girls at the school. I wasn't the only girl by the end. But weirdly, I did the kind of 10,000 hours thing by mistake. Yeah.
So did you do grades or anything, or is it just...
I did, yeah. I did all the grades. And I mean, God, if you heard me now, I mean, I can play a bit, but not compared to how I used to be able to play. But it was my absolute passion. And even now, actually, if I, after this, I probably will play something because it's reminded me I've got a piano and I can. But whenever I do get back into playing the piano, it's an amazingly important thing for me. And I always think, why don't I just do this more? I did quite a bit of it in lockdown. Obviously, when I ran out of needlepoint, sourdough, starter kits,
banana cakes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I totally get what you're saying about music because it was a big escape for me, particularly in my sort of late teens. Particularly playing something. I think there's a sort of chemical change listening to music in ourselves, but also playing something, you're concentrating on that, and also feeling the music. It's a very visceral experience playing an instrument, I think. So I totally get where you're coming from with that. What kind of stuff were you playing? Was it mainly classical music or contemporary stuff?
It was classical, yeah. So that's the weird, and there's been a bit of a metaphor there for everything creative I've ever gone on to do. So I was very, very accomplished technically. I could read music. I would absolutely, classic Cali, if it was Bach and you had to be quiet here, louder, you know, I'd do all of that beautifully. Be very studious, follow the rules creatively. And then when I got to sixth form college, I got really into drama. I'd done quite a bit of drama, but I got massively into drama there. I did drama A level and they had amazing drama at that college. And I got to know this guy called Johnny Boston, who was from a family. Right, he was dead cool. And he had to be with the name Johnny Boston. He was the youngest of, I think, 5 brothers. And the downstairs of their house was like a studio. All his brothers were into music. And he was a really good like jazz pianist. And he was totally kind of loose and everything he'd done. He couldn't read music. And then I didn't ever get good at it, but I realized a restraining thing in a way. So I'm this tightly classically trained musician. He's just really able to just do stuff. And it's a bit like that with comedy and everything else I do. Like I can do it within the rules of doing it. I can be quite glossy. But can I just be totally loose and just see what happens and turn up and inhabit the room like the brilliant comics do? But I still can't. So it probably was a bit of a metaphor for everything that went on to happen. So yeah, totally classically, rigidly trained. That's what I
It's really interesting because I think I talked about this on a podcast a little while ago that when late in my later teens, I had to share a flat with my dad and my nan. It was a bit awkward because it was one bedroom, so it was a bit, and I was getting older, and so this family nearby who I'd met through a youth group, they put me up in, they had a spare room and they put me up, and the mum was really keen, like her children had, again, like you, classically trained on the piano and thought that the route into music, if I wanted to do music as a kind of career, I needed to sort of train basically, and before that I'd just been playing in my bedroom, learning songs and blah blah blah.
What were you playing? Guitar?
Guitar. And
when you said teenage boy bedroom,
went guitar. Yeah, it's that route. Yeah. Really. But so she organised for me to have some, like for a birthday present or Christmas gift, I think that she organised me to have some guitar lessons so I could learn, you know, and she'd kind of instructed the guy to teach me like very technical stuff so I could do grades and, you know, become technical. And within the first lesson, like he said, just play with me. And he had a keyboard actually, and he was really into blues and jazz. And he said, just play with me for a minute. And then, so we played for about half an hour. And he said, I'm not going to teach you all that grade stuff. He goes, I just want to teach you about improvisation. Now it could have been that he was like, I just want to have a jam with you. Basically. I don't want to like have to teach you like pop stuff, but I used to go along every week and we used to jam together and he would play stuff and I'd play. And I learned so much from doing that improvisation. And for me, that stood me in place because I will take a chance on stuff. If I hit a bum note, so what? It's a learning curve, you know, it goes to that sort of feeling about failure and stuff. If you do hit a bum note, then it's fine. You can go again. And I honestly got to meet, he still lives in the road behind us when we moved, and I went and had a cup of tea with him, and he's obviously quite elderly now. And I just said to him, thank you so much for giving me that confidence to do that, because, you know, all the bands I've played and everything, we just always would improvise and mess around with stuff, and all our best content used to come out of that. And it was had such a huge impact on me creatively.
I think that's it's a really amazing story. I'm wondering why you didn't pick that as your namaste motherfucking
I should have done, shouldn't I?
Save the goosebumps for your own.
Yeah, big shout out to Graham Tucker, his name is. And
it's no Johnny Boston, guy. But it's a good name.
No, and I just was so grateful to him, and it was nice to be able to go and say that to him and say, thank you so much for that impact you had on me. And I'm so pleased that I didn't do any grades and I just, you know, you allowed me to just express myself.
Because he probably, it's taken me another, how long since I was at that school? Nearly 50 years since I was at that school. It's taken me this long to try and learn to be a bit looser with life and with creative things and with my relationship with failure and experimentation. I've been very experimental in other areas of my life, but creatively and professionally, I've been a real tightly coiled spring and you kind of had to be, I guess, doing what I used to do for a living. It didn't, you got rewarded for that kind of attitude, but it's kind of a price to pay. So what was he called? Graham Tucker. Thank you, Graham Tucker. Now other people will be listening and they've got Graham Tucker's approach by proxy.
So, I thought you were going to say, they've got Graham Tuckers in their life. I'm sure everyone's got a Graham
Tucker. That's true, actually. Yeah.
Somewhere.
People will be writing in now to you guys with their Graham Tuckers.
Oh, I'd like that.
If people sent us emails, they would do. Yeah.
People send you a lot of emails. Jim, cut that bit out.
Sorry. People send us loads of emails all the time. Coming in. Can't move. We've actually stopped saying the email address in the outro because no one sends us any emails at all. I don't know why. Do we give a vibe of people that don't answer emails? I don't know. Anyway,
no one reads emails anymore.
That's
all WhatsApp groups.
And people putting stuff out on social media, which I like, because then you can just retweet the shit out of it. Tell me you like my podcast, I can share it.
Free advertising.
Exactly.
Yeah. So is that something you've wanted to be creatively, sort of looser and stuff? Because when you were talking earlier about sort of being in the box and stuff, I was thinking, like, I guess there is still space for everything, really, isn't there? And if you're the sort of person that thrives in a more rigid structure of creativity, then that's cool. There's no rule, is there? There's no hard or fast rule. But I guess, is that something you wanted to do? In terms of,
I do think I do think inhabiting what you're doing in the moment is certainly for live works pretty important. You could argue it's quite important for anything creative, even when you're not doing it in front of people. And I do think that, yeah, that's probably the thing I've most, in every way, in terms of how I've structured my career, literally moving out of a very structured, responsible job into something that isn't structured and is arguably not at all responsible, but also like approach on stage. I was interviewing Sarah Keyworth for my podcast this morning. I think she's incredible, really talented comic, and the absolute opposite of me in terms of how loose she is. And I've watched her since the beginning. We started out pretty much together, and I was saying to her, God, I just aspire to have your presence on stage. And I think, yeah, I have got loose on stage, but that's why I know I'm a better MC than a comic, because when I'm MCing, I'm just turning up and mucking around with the room, yeah, and the audience. And I know that's much funnier than the stuff I painstakingly write. So yeah, I don't know, people listening and you guys doing what you do for a living, and your listeners listening to this podcast about this subject will have their opinions. But I do think if you could be rigid in terms of your discipline, which I'm also not, of like, I'm going to write for 6 hours a day.
Yeah.
So I'm loose in discipline and application and rigid in delivery. So it's absolutely brilliant. Oh. And I don't know why I'm not even more successful than I am.
You have to say, obviously, for anyone listening doesn't know, like with MC work, you do have to just approach it more loosely. Like,
Do you do any prep? Do you find out who the comics are?
I always find out who the comics are, because I've almost got, it's not quite facial blindness, but I think it almost does verge into that. Actually, I'm absolutely appalling with faces. So nowadays I do look up the names. By the way. That's why I like Zoom, seriously, because everyone's got their names on. Otherwise I'm good at names, just not good at faces. I would know which you were, but if I then bumped into you in the street, I might genuinely.
All right, Jim.
I might genuinely.
I'd probably go with it and say, yeah, it's going well. The football stuff's going
well. And that's
well,
even more depressing because I've known forward Paddy to since Edinburgh 2015.
Yeah, I might know you, Jim, because I've met you. Because Giles and I haven't actually met, I might not know. But I do, and because, no offence to either of you, but there are quite a lot of white guys doing comedy. So what I do is when the list comes through, I'll always very quickly just partly to see who they are. And then usually I'll be like, oh, yes, I have work. I remember material always, but also just to see if we follow each other. Because I'm like, okay, not only I definitely have met you then, because we follow each other.
Yeah.
So I do that. But beyond that, I mean, I'm doing a corporate tonight. I'm hosting a thing for a media agency, and I've done a bit of prep. I've asked, like, is there anyone I can take the piss out of? Who's the big name? Is there anyone you would rather I didn't take the piss out of? But I actually think the more you do beyond a couple of gags about their industry, the more you've prepped, the worse it is. I think it's much better if something happens in the room. But it's weird, isn't it? I've got the confidence to do that as an MC, but don't have the confidence to do that in any other way. I don't know what that's about. So
just really quickly, I did an MC gig recently where I forgot one of the acts' names, and I literally had to go back and pop my head through the door and say, sorry, what was your name again? Killed the room. It was a terrible moment. Next up is, and I went, I'm so sorry, I forgot the acts' name. Which is all, I mean, you've got one job. You've literally got one job.
The worst thing, because if it's...
How horrendous for that poor comic.
If the name is something like your name, Jim, that's the thing I'm always really wary of, is if it's a name that's less familiar to me, from a culture that's less familiar to me, I'm so aware of, don't be like, well, that's difficult to remember, because they'll probably be thinking, well, I think your name's difficult to remember.
Yeah.
So I'm always really I did the Angel Comedy, their social club nights they have, which have quite a lot of comics on of different levels. And there were so many names there that were like, to me, seemed complex, and names I hadn't worked with. Yeah. So I just had it on my phone, and then I would just remember the next name. I'd make sure before I went on, I was like, but I definitely know who's up next. And then at the end, when I do the recap of each section, so give it up for the acts you've seen. And then you do the kind of like, I hope you're clapping really loudly, because I can't remember them.
Yeah, mumble into the microphone.
I thought so too.
I'm just trying to think if there's a way you can kind of adopt some of that feeling and that kind of technique towards your other work, so that you do feel a bit less loose. Or is it just because you're so prepared with regards to you're writing lots of material that you want to stick to that and be faithful to what you've written?
I think it's, so first of all, and Jim will know this, and it'll have come up on your podcast before probably, but when you do the clubs, if they pay you for 20, they do not want you to do much crowd work, because they think that's the job of the MC. So if you do a 20 and of that 3 minutes were crowd work, they're not always that happy. which I actually find a real shame, because I know not to steal the crowd work from the MC, because I'm an MC. So I won't take things that are theirs that they need. But I do. So the way I do it is, I know I have jumping off points quite regularly where I do need to ask an audience member something. And even if it's for 15 seconds, I'm like, you know, I'm in my 50s. Any women in their 50s? Oh, what's your name? You know, quick bit. And then I can play with the audience live, but within material. I do find it. I think that's the disadvantage of not doing Edinburgh, isn't it? Is that I'm not doing it this year, and you have to be a bit looser, because if you're creating an hour, you've got to take some risks, or you'll never get as far as an hour in the 6 to 9 months you have to write it. So you absolutely should be able to apply that. I do now write material verbally, so I always just record it, often on the way back from gigs, and then I'll try it that way. So, but I reckon it would take me another 10 years as a comedian to get where I want to go in terms of looseness. I do know what I don't know, and I also know how long it would take to get there, having worked in that industry. And I'm like, oh, good. So by the time I'm 70, I'm going to be so good at this.
Well, should we talk about the moment then you got into comedy? Because it's a fairly unique story, isn't it? If you want to explain to our listeners how you switched careers big time.
Yeah, it was a bit of an unexpected switch. So I worked in the media. I'd always worked in telly. I'd kind of ended up in senior management in telly, but without meaning to. And I was quite unhappy as a kind of boardroom person, but didn't probably admit that, but did love the bits of the job that were more creative, and I did love managing people and hopefully I think leaving a decent sort of halo for people beneath and around me in the companies I worked for. But I didn't like all the bullshit in boardrooms at all, and I was doing it, you know, when it was quite a bit of a harder thing to do as a woman and as a younger woman. But I had then inadvertently found myself with some kind of benefits in the job. And I worked for Viacom CBS for a long time. I used to work for MTV back in the day before they were part of Viacom. And then I went back in. So I ended up there, and Viacom owns Comedy Central, among other brands. And I worked for the US Comedy Central.
Oh, okay.
I worked from here, but I was employed by them. And we would bring A-list talent to, you know, trade fairs in Cannes or wherever. And I was the boring business person who would be charged with introducing whoever the A-lister was to the stage. And there'd be drunken TV executives, and I would be the one who would have to keep the room a little bit warm till the A-lister came out. And it was purely a sort of cynical event to get the jaded TV executives to part with their money and buy the show. And I worked with Joan Rivers a couple of times, and got to know her quite well. I absolutely admired her. It's because of people like her. I grew up knowing women could be funny, but I didn't expect to take to her quite to the level I did. And I had never thought what a feminist she was. I never thought what it was like to be breaking through those glass ceilings in Hollywood. And some of the stories she told me about what it was like as a woman then, I was like, wow, actually, I've slightly underestimated the nuanced nature of Joan Rivers. She was the person who said to me she was the one who said the odds are good and the goods are odd about online dating.
I've thought about that every time since you said that. I've thought about that a lot, actually.
That was one bit of life advice she gave me about her daughter who was out there online dating at the time. But the last time I saw her, we had dinner together, just the two of us, wow. As it turned out, not long before she died. Obviously didn't know that at the time. And she was the one who said to me, Kelly, you should think about doing stand-up comedy, because what you've been doing for me at all these events is kind of being my warm-up and you could do it. And I said, I was 45 at the time. And I said, you know, I'm 45. I'm a single mum. One of my kids has got special needs. I've got a massive day job. It's too late. And she just looked at me and she said, Kelly, I'm 81. You're in the thick of it. Why don't you do it? And then she died very unexpectedly 2 weeks later, which was also a bit of a leveler, because at 81, she seemed very, I mean, who knows what age she actually was. She was declaring to be 81. Right. But she did that. So 97, Joan Rivers.
Yeah.
I think it was the combination of her giving me that advice and actually, ironically, her dying and me thinking, I'm so glad that when I was 45, someone who was 81 told me 45 was quite young.
Yeah.
Because at 53, I now know 45 is quite young. And I'm also very mindful of the fact that when I'm 60, I'll be thinking 53 was young.
Yeah.
So I think it's so important to, it's not about, my story is not at all redemptive. My life's still really messy. I really struggle with many, many things. I find life on stage much easier than life off stage. And I suspect that will always be the way. But what I do love about what she said, and what I do think is a bit of portable something that might make people think, is just about, I'll decide what I'm going to do, and I'll decide whether it's an unlikely life moment or not, and I'll decide at what age in my life how I would like to be. And everyone has that right, whether they're 13 or 93. And so I suppose that's the bit that I think is the take out from that, is not what I went on to do, but that she was like, you decide what you do at what age and who you are and how, it's up to you. And that was very liberating at a point when I had a very serious career. I probably would have thought, oh, I'll do this another 10 years, I can retire, never work again, just slog on. And a bit of me was like, no, don't slog on, it's not too late, just crack on. So yeah, that was my sort of unexpected fork in the road.
Yeah, it's interesting you use the word slog, because I think the idea of slogging on, you know, like it's against your will in a way.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite telling that you use that word.
It is. Well, I think I tell you the time I think that jobs reach their sell by day. And I should add, I did have great privilege in that I was a high earner then. So it gave me some leeway. So when I was first working as a stand-up, I didn't need to rely on money from it. I absolutely need to make a living outside of, I don't have a corporate job anymore. And I'm lucky that I do corporate speaking based largely on that career, not on being a stand-up. But I do think, I've worked as a coach to people for the last 20 odd years. I've coached a lot of different types of people. And if the money is what's keeping you in something, it's time to look for something else.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean you don't still need to earn the money. I absolutely, there's no other money comes into my household. No other money has supported my kids. So it wasn't a luxury item earning money, but there are possibly more ways to think about doing it than you might imagine. So and it was a slog actually. I mean, if I'm honest, and I've thought about starting to bring this into my corporate speaking, because I haven't actually said it on stage and it's probably a bit disingenuous, that what I fudge over in that whole story, because then about 3 years later, when I was in my late 40s, I gave up the day job and I switched to making a living out of what I now do, you know, speaking, comedy, writing. But what I don't talk about is the fact I had a complete full-on burnout and there was absolutely no way I could carry on with my board level job. So if I hadn't been a stand-up, I'd have still left. Mm-hmm. So perhaps I need to be more honest about that with people, particularly for women who, I don't know many, I know you guys are a bit younger than me, but I don't know many women who in their late 40s haven't had a pretty big life collapse. And it's perimenopause, which isn't talked about nearly enough.
Yeah, no.
Menopause now gets a good spotlight, but the people I know, if there's a time you did not want to exist anymore, it was perimenopause, and I was in the thick of it. And I couldn't cope anymore. So ironically, it sounds like a really brave, amazing story, but it was also driven by well-being and necessity, actually.
I mean, not bad things to let drive your decisions, to be honest. I mean, those are important.
And I definitely should talk. I'm aware, like I say, I came away doing a speech last week and I thought, oh, that bit's missing. That's quite important. I need to start telling people that bit. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's something that isn't talked about enough and doesn't get as much airtime as it should. And I think, you know, like you say, I think there are lots and lots of women going through that and probably feeling a little lost in those times.
Yeah, the average age for women to commit suicide is 51, and the average age for women to go through menopause is 53. And I don't think that's talked about. We talk a lot, and may we continue to, about young men's mental health and men's mental health and the fact that men maybe don't always have those kind of conversations when they need their help. But actually, I think it's fair. I mean, I suspect you guys wouldn't have necessarily been aware of that statistic. I don't think there's a lot out there about that.
No.
And actually, it's the lead up. And you know, I certainly got to the point where I if I hadn't had kids, I don't think I would still be here. And I know a significant number of women who've been at that same point. And at best, women who are losing careers, relationships. A huge amount at that stage in life. And I don't think it is talked about enough. And I also think if it was men going through it, we'd have resolved that ages ago, because if you think about it, those are women at the peak of their careers. I left my career when I was at the absolute top of my game. Yeah. And I could have been at the top of my game for another 5 years, I reckon, and still been really on it, helpful, useful, valuable to them. And it never came up in my leaving discussions. My mental health did. And I felt like I'd become a pariah for them, you know, that I had mental health issues that I talked about, but I never mentioned that aspect of things. So yeah, it sounds like a lovely story, which it kind of is. I don't regret any of it, but it didn't come about from happy, daring, creative impulses. It came about from survival, I think. Yeah,
thank you for sharing that stat, because you're right, I've never heard that, and I can't remember seeing anything about it. And yet you're right about men's mental health, and I think the average age for men to commit suicide is much younger, I believe.
I think it's possibly 20s. And I should add with that statistic, that was a statistic. I did a lot of research on it when I did my show Invisible, which was 3 years ago. So it could well be that statistic shifted, but it won't have shifted a lot. So it could be there's now research saying it's 52 or 49. Mm. But for women, this is sniper alley for women, mental health wise, what I'm in now. And it's interesting, isn't it? The stuff's just gone out in the press about women not being able to get their HRT and there being supply problems and women sort of meeting in car parks. If someone's managed to get some, they'll give it to someone else, like a dealer. And I was like, that is a non-story. Me and my mates, like, we'll all go to different GPs consciously and all go to different pharmacists on the back of the fact someone will get it. We've all been, that's the only reason women go to Pilates. It's because that's where you do your HRT deals. That's it. Otherwise, it's not for our pelvic floors. It's just to get our drugs. So.
Wow. It's making middle-aged women see a lot more gangster.
But again, horrendous. I thought they were. Horrendous that you're not able to get hold of these beneficial medications.
Yeah.
You know, it's just
and that doctors will say to you, so you'll be get put as a middle-aged woman, it's much easier to get antidepressants than it is to get your hormones adjusted. I've been on hormone replacement therapy for nearly 20 years because I had a cervical condition that meant I needed it very young. And I have to really negotiate with my GP to make, I absolutely know it's linked to breast cancer. I'm an intelligent woman. I understand the risk. I also understand the risk of me not being on it, mental health wise. Yeah. And I've literally said, well, either I can be on this planet Earth taking it, or I don't think I'll survive even without it. So I will decide to take that risk if that's all right. Thanks for pointing it out to me. But I don't know if men would, or if, I don't know. I don't know why we're having to negotiate for something that we need. You wouldn't just take a diabetic off insulin and go, well, we've decided there is a risk with insulin. And we know it helps you out, but we've decided actually it's better for you not to have it for a year. So you just wouldn't do it. And it is actually, I didn't mean to come on here and do a perimenopausal, awareness speech, but it is actually a matter of life and death, I would say, without over-egging it.
No, it's not.
You're right,
It's not over-egging it at all. I think it's really important that we discuss it. I've seen some posts on social media recently, and obviously we've had the issues with the supply chains and stuff of getting those amount of medications. And I know my wife's got colleagues at work who've had the issues and going, like you say, doing deals in the car parks. And I guess, again, it's the start. You think, you know, as a man, not really knowing enough about these situations, just it's like a stark story that's being played out, and it's horrible to hear.
It's also worth you, because you guys are you in your 40s, both of you?
I am.
Nearly. Yeah, nearly.
So one in your 30s, one in your 40s. So it's also worth being aware, and this is semi-joking, but not really. So my dating pool is obviously usually divorced men. I mean, I say usually, they're always separated. I don't mean sometimes they're married still, but usually they're men who've separated from their partners and have got kids with a previous partner or a previous couple of partners. And very often the marriages, that's partly because of the age I am, but very often the marriages broke down in their late 40s, early 50s. And I also do think that there is an element also, it probably is really hard for the men as well, but there's such a massive change and such a lot of challenge for any woman at that life stage, that it's also probably really incredibly tough for the woman and probably really tough for the man too. Mm. And I definitely think a number of guys that I've met, they were like, my wife just got really difficult. And it was, and I sort of am thinking, well, she was 49 when you split up. Yeah. She probably was being fucking difficult. Good on her. So I do think it does. There is I don't know if the research has been done, but if you look at the age that women get divorced, I bet you there's a peak at that stage in life as well. So just look out for that, guys. Try and be very nice.
Okay,
unload the dishwasher at that point a lot.
I'm not allowed to.
Put the dog out for a poo all the time.
But that one, I know, as a bloke in his late 30s and with friends in a similar age and stuff, and I guess maybe why would my mates not know about that, but this is literally the first time I've ever had a conversation with anybody about this kind of thing. Like, it's just never, it's not on any bloke that I know's radar or anything like that. And yet this is what you're telling me is absolutely vital. At some point, it's life-saving information. It's just
life-saving and relationship saving. I think it is, and it's actually, it's basically kind of, it's hard to be empathetic, isn't it, when we're not, if you think about empathy being literally trying to stand in someone else's shoes.
Yeah.
It's really hard to do that when you don't know what the starting point is. Like, there would be absolutely issues you guys would be aware of that I probably wouldn't be aware of as a woman, where I'd be like, oh God, actually I hadn't really even thought about what that's like for you guys. And so I do think it's, I think we've gone so mad on menopause. I don't think we're looking at the transitionary, which is much worse. And it's also at a time when you've got huge, if you think about women in their 40s, very likely that if they're going to have kids, they've probably got kids where they're at the front line of parenting. You know, I'm now at the light of touch, empty nest end. And it's when you've got it coming from all sides, career, relationship, you know, kids, the whole thing. So, yeah, I think it's just worth people being aware of. And you do hear about women. There's a lot of women who start really interesting businesses in their late 40s and early 50s. And a lot of that is for similar reasons to mine.
Yeah.
So it ends up a great story. But actually, we got there for not very great reasons. Yeah.
Well, again, thank you for sharing that, because I think it's, like you say, it's important for people who are listening who might be going through a similar situation and being aware that that might be why they're feeling the way they are.
And to insist to their GPs, one last thing.
Yes.
Your GPs may well say you don't need it, or they test your levels and go, no, you're fine. You think you need it, get them to give it to you. And the only way HRT works is trial and error. And if any doctor says, we're not going to trial and error it with you and you're over 45, then just find another doctor.
So is that trial and error on dosage levels?
On dosage, yeah. So you need, estrogen is the kind of key one that you usually need, but you often need a sort of bouquet of estrogen, progesterone and testosterone. But yeah, and literally the only way they can do it is they give you a small dose, and if that works, you don't need a bigger dose. Yeah. And that's the way it is.
My goes back to Joan Rivers, isn't it? It's your choice.
Yeah. It's your choice, yeah. And it should be, really should be, for our bodies.
Yeah.
Quite.
My wife's got underactive thyroid, so she has thyroxine, which she takes every day, and that again is you have to sort of work out the dosage levels, and it takes
and
a little
fight your GP for that. I have that as well. That's another one where they're kind of, and you're kind of like, and actually the threshold on the NHS for when you need thyroxine is pretty high.
It's totally different. So my sister-in-law's also got it. It's quite unusual for sisters to have it, and in the States it's totally different. Totally different kind of, you know, they're more readily available drugs.
Yeah, you don't even have to have a thyroid condition.
No, no, you just have it.
Gun and thyroxine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And a copy of the Constitution.
Try this.
And a latte. Yeah.
It's very true. But yeah, it's funny. And I hear it's you have to be like over four or something before they really start. Anyway, whatever.
Not over 4 years old.
No. I meant there's like the thyroid.
Jim's like, what do you mean over four?
Yeah.
Clarification.
He's wondering if his kid can have it.
She's about, a year away, so I'm sure we'll work it out.
Oh, God, it's a minefield. So what were those first? I mean, obviously you did make that choice to go into comedy. What were the first few gigs like?
Well, Jim and I did my first ever gig.
Oh, you did your first ever gig?
Oh, that was your first ever one?
It was my first ever outside of the course. So I did one, I did the showcase.
Yeah.
Please say that you walked off and said, follow that, Jim.
Yeah, exactly. Mike drew up and then Jim died on his arse. Yeah. And he knew that he should quit and I should get into it.
Jim was emceeing and he went, next on... What's the name again?
I'm so sorry. Yeah. I've done it again. Kelly Holmes, I think she is. So my first gig was the second gig in the real world, the one in the toilet that we did, Jim. But the first gig was the showcase, end of a course, above a pub, and I was really good on the course. I was one of the ones who could write and perform, and they put me as last in the showcase. I'm sure thinking, she'll be, and I absolutely died on my ass because I'd learnt it like a script.
Yeah.
It wasn't funny. And then I was so surprised because I just thought, I'm going to be the next Sarah Millican, no doubt. And I was like, oh, shit. Then I did the Comedy Virgins at the Cavendish Arms and I won that night, that little tiny trophy.
So I won that
gig. Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. So I had a diabolical gig. Then I won a competition, which, to be fair, for anyone listening, it's not exactly like Edinburgh Newcomer of the Year, but it was a little.
It's not Perrier Award.
Yeah, it's something.
It's not the Perrier Award, but it's the only award I had. And then the third gig was in a toilet with Jim Daly, with the legendary Jim Daly, either emceeing or headlining. I don't know which you
can't remember. I'm not sure it was either.
No, though. You were definitely the only act who knew how to be a comedian. I remember that.
We should say converted toilet as well for anyone wondering. It was less than salubrious bar. I think,
a lot of venues are.
Yeah, it was one of the early adopters of the converting of toilets, wasn't it?
Yeah, we used to play at the Tunbridge Wells Forum.
I knew you'd say Tunbridge Wells.
I know, because that is a converted toilet, a Victorian
toilet venue.
Yeah, but it's just.
I've been out toileted now. Ours was just some shitty. Ours wasn't even one of those underground hip ones. There's one near me in Kentish Town called Ladies and Gents, which is a really, really good toilet-based bar, a cocktail bar. But this one was like, it was more like one you'd see on the seafront in Eastbourne, wasn't it? It was like a sort of toilet.
Nice.
By the road, like some car park toilet rather than a cool underground. Yeah. It was basically a car park toilet.
It was a drug deal toilet. There was another one on the circuit of the open my circuit. There was a toilet as well somewhere. I want to say Liverpool Street or something that was also not the best.
Was there a trend for converting toilets?
It had weird uplighting. Green uplighting as well, which was a very interesting choice.
Green uplighting in a toilet. Oh, that'll be because of the, well, in when I lived in Amsterdam, it was the reason they had that lighting. They, in all the toilets, I don't think they do it now, they had that like ultraviolet type blue light because you couldn't shoot up with that. So all toilets, even in department stores, when I lived over there in the 90s, they all had that blue lighting.
Wow, that shows how naive I am. That's just, yeah, I'm not in, not in the drug world at all.
Come on, Lou Reed over here telling you that how it is. Come on.
But you, so anyway, going back to the showcase and the course and stuff, like you obviously had already come to that course. I've done one of the courses as well. That's how I started as well. And like a lot of people are going off and doing those courses with literally no experience of ever being in front of a room, ever written anything, hold a microphone or anything. But you had clearly come with the skills from previous work of, yeah, you know, as Joan Rivers has said to you, basically doing warm-up stuff and almost doing comedy.
Well, I tell you what, I did have the skills to do, and this is, I think, a massive disadvantage in terms of how I've progressed as a comic. I had stagecraft and stage presence, so I knew how to hold a room because I was used to addressing, you know, thousands of people in auditoriums, and I was a reasonably loose corporate speaker, as in I would not need too much of a script, and I kind of liked it, and I was a bit funny. But that got me a long way in covering up for the fact I wasn't actually doing anything very authentic. So I could come up with all right material, but I could deliver it as if I'd been going quite a long time. And I think that means, so I did really well for the first couple of years because I was probably came across as better than a lot of my contemporaries, but I wasn't better. And I didn't have to dig as deep for material because I just hid behind technique. So, and I definitely, even now, actually, I can be quite lazy with material because I sort of know, that's why I like emceeing, I kind of know I'll probably be all right. And even if I've not got a single new joke in there, I can probably hold the night okay and still come across as all right. So it's not a good thing at all. So I didn't have any great comedic genius. I didn't have any genius, but certainly anything I could do was stagecraft related, but a bit too much so. I've spent the last 7 years trying to get less polished because no one really wants a polished comedian. That's like, there's nothing funny about someone looking like they've got their shit together.
Yeah, true. We want them,
like,
to piss
off. Yeah.
Want them to be a complete
brushed
mess.
Hair, and clean teeth, and a bit of money in the bank. We don't like you.
So yeah, how does that look then as a performance? You know, obviously, if you're very scripted, what are you? Is it to do with interaction with the audience? Is it the delivery? Is it allowing time and space? How does that? How would you?
It's all of that. So what I do before I got, because I used to teach people to do public speaking. I think we talked about it last time that Chris Sutton came on my podcast, and it was because I'd worked with some ex-Premier League footballers to become after dinner speakers. So I do bits of training for people in public speaking and after dinner speaking. And the couple of big things that are so important, and it's the same in comedy, I think, is to think about turning up. So the last thing you think about before you go on stage is I need to inhabit it. I need to be present, absolutely mentally present to that moment. And how I'm going to say it is far more important than anything I think I'm going to say content-wise. So go for the how, not the what. And it's exactly what you just said, but so hard to do. It's like your words will never save you. So what are you going to, it's your kind of presence and your capacity to be loose. I remember I'm reading something or listening to Ramesh talking about, I think, his second show, and because he had such runaway success with his first show, he got really stuck with his second show, like second album syndrome. And I think it was someone like Sean Walsh or somebody who was one of his contemporaries just turned up to one of his work in progress second show and just said, mate, you don't seem like you're even enjoying that anymore. Loosen up. And he realized, he was like, I've got to make this amazing. And so it's weird, isn't it? Because with creative endeavors, the harder you try, I know when I have a bad gig nowadays, it gets harder to know what the bad gig was. In the beginning, it's so obvious. It's like I did that Colin King stupid thing. Now it's a bit more subtle and alchemous. And if there's anything I can pin it down to, it's being too desperate to be liked and it isn't going well. And I'm really a bit like me. And they're like, no, thanks. So I think there's something about all of those things you said. But Christ, if I knew what that was and I could bottle it and wheel it out, I'd be selling out arenas. You know, I don't know. I know the theory a bit. I don't really know how to do it. What do you guys think about it? Because you're both obviously doing the same thing, right? Trying to deliver something loose, authentic, funny, brilliant. You know, it's really hard.
Jim's trying harder than I am.
That's because you naturally do it, Jonathan.
It's because of Graham Tucker. He's taught me all about this improv.
The old Tuck effect.
Yeah.
I need to see Graham for a cup of tea. That's my problem. It's funny you say about sort of just needing to be liked and stuff, because I think that is kind of a core element of anyone doing creative stuff. I don't think you can turn that off. Like, I think you can learn to maybe harness it a bit, maybe, but I don't think you can ever necessarily turn that off, because that's kind of why we're on stage, isn't it?
You cannot exude it though, right? Like, you can there's something about, so, you know, when a gig's going badly, somebody said to me quite early on, that's when you slow down and take all the time and go into the audience, go talk to them, whereas at that point you're inclined to go, right, I'm not even going to talk to you, you're a very unpleasant inconvenience, I'll just recite the last bit of my script and I'll go. And actually it takes a lot of courage to do that. But if a gig's going badly now and I think people don't like me, I won't say, I think it's not a fatal error to go, well, I can see you're not enjoying this as much as I am, but I'll just try and find something to have a bit of banter with them about. And sometimes if somebody cracks a bit and warms to you, they start to go your way. But yeah, I mean, some people say, don't they, I really don't care if I have a bad gig anymore, like it's their problem. And I think, no, I'll always care. I'll always think it's my problem.
Yeah.
It's hard. Yeah. Instant rejection.
I think you'll always internalize that still. Like, I don't think you'd stop doing that. But I think as well, if you're having a bad gig, it's okay to sort of like say that on stage. Audiences know that you're having a bad gig, so there's no point trying to pretend you're not. But if you're
they don't always know as much as you think they do.
Really?
I definitely think that. And I think as we've got better, then they know less. So I think now what we think is a bad gig would probably have been a good gig when we were newer. So when you think about the audience, it just depends on their expectation. And I do sometimes think when we think we've had I think we know when we've had a stinker.
Yeah.
But if it's just one of those where you think they're looking at you a bit like you're not really for me, I don't think they always are. I think usually they're just Dutch. No, I can say that because my kids are half Dutch. I'm not just being randomly xenophobic.
Yeah. Thanks for the caveat.
But yeah, I do a lot of gigs in Holland and they do tend to look at you like that and then come up and say, that was hilarious. And you're like, I thought you hated me.
You didn't smile once. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, perspective angle is interesting. Because I guess is it because you as a performer are maybe looking for something different from the gig, or your parameters are different?
Yeah, I always say that when I'm training people in public speaking, I'm like, you're the only one who knew what you meant to say. So if you go totally miss that middle bit and there was a really good bit you meant to say, they didn't know. So either say it later or go like, yeah, okay, I could have done with that, but I'll work on without it. They don't know. And it's same with comedy. They don't know what we were trying to do or, you know, they don't know. So yeah, I definitely think I see it a lot as an MC. I see acts who haven't died on their ass referring to dying on their ass live, or at the end going, well, I enjoyed that, shame you didn't. And I think, actually, no, you could have just given them your Twitter handle and gone off on a high, they'd have gone with it. So no self-deprecation on stage, Jim, that's my advice to you.
I've said this to Jim as well.
Jim a bit of a self-deprecator?
He is, he's very hard on himself,
Jim.
I have been through my previews a bit, but I think I will knock that out for
I think it can be a turn off for people, actually, if you're too like, sorry guys, it's rubbish.
I've done a lot of that's getting cut in the final show.
That's okay. Mine is my favourite one for new material nights for others, or when I'm doing new material myself, is, you know, and this is gonna be lots of new material, so you'll be seeing some jokes making their debut and their farewell performances.
Exactly.
And that's it. Everybody goes, great, that's fine. Yeah. So, but I think self-deprecation is a tricky one, isn't it?
But what if it is your nature? Like, what if that just kind of is, you know?
It is my nature too, actually. And I really try to unlearn it a bit, because I know people have said, also people think it's a bit disingenuous if they think you're quite funny. And there's certain status hard, to being up there with a mic. And you're up there holding a microphone, they're probably thinking, well, how much of a dick do you think you are? Or you wouldn't be there. We know we're up there because we are complete dicks. But they might mistake us holding the mic for having some conviction in our own stories.
So the self-deprecation thing is hard, because sometimes I think it's a mixture of things, isn't it? Because one, it can be, like I say, some people might think that you're fishing, you know, fishing for some sort of validation or some nice kind words, which is generally, I don't think most people I know that self-deprecate aren't looking for that. It's just genuine, like they feel crappy about themselves or unenthusiastic about what they've just done. So that's a big part of it, I think. But I do think, people, I think it is a bit of, not a turn off, that's probably not the right word, but I think people, you can irritate people by doing it. I know, because I'm like it as well. And I think it does irritate people sometimes, especially when they think, oh, you're doing an amazing thing, you know, You're doing. Oh, look, you're doing. You're living the dream. You're making a living doing what you love. Stop whinging about it.
I think there is an element of that, and also it's a scale, isn't it? So I used to do stuff about how I looked, and I do stuff physically about, you know, changes in my body, and that is my right to say that. I know what my body used to be in my 20s. I know what my body's like now. But then I realised, well, there will be women my age in the audience going, well, sorry, like, to me, you look good. And I don't think I do, but it's not very fair on me to be going and look at my big fat stomach and I'm this, because they might be like, what? That's made me feel really bad.
Yeah.
So I think I did realize, don't really do, because you're not actually just punching down to yourself. You're punching down to anyone who might also think you look worse than you do, or still got a tummy after a cesarean or whatever. Maybe they're thinking, well, hold on a minute, you've just set the bar somewhere I think's too high, even though I think I know who I'm comparing myself to. So I think there's a physical element as well of like not punching down about how you look, because that might be really upsetting for someone else.
That's really interesting as well, because you're showing a very sort of empathetic sort of approach to your audience there, which obviously I think is important, because you need to create a relationship with them on stage. But a lot of comedy, a lot of comedians like to make themselves the butt of the joke. So, you know, rather, because you don't want to punch down, maybe you're punching up against some sort of, you know, society or something, but politicians or whatever. But if you're making yourself the butt of the joke, but at the same time trying to make sure that you're not then involving members of the audience in that's a tricky minefield to
I think you can navigate. Just avoid certain, so I do avoid physical, I have a couple of jokes about menopausal bodies, but they're not, it's quite a bit more loose and couldn't really offend anyone, and it's just my observation that's kind of tied into sort of politics and stuff. But I do know when I did what show was it? Supercali Fragile Lipstick. My first solo show was largely about my son's autism.
Great name, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
I wish I'd saved that name for when I had a good show. But anyway, not to worry.
Can you bring it back? Can you kind of resurrect it somehow?
Yeah. Supercali Fragile Lipstick, the sequel. Yeah. And there's no room on the poster then for my face. But yeah. But that show was about my son's autism and about his love of animals. And it had like little callbacks all the way through, like his commenting on me. I'd say something and he'd be like, well, no, that can't be the case. You know, me saying a sort of a saying about an animal in it and him debunking it. But that show was really well received by people who were autistic and by the National Autistic Society. And it was a real championing of my autistic son and complete punching down. If to anyone, it was always to me. Like I learned this life lessons from my son, who's way better at life than me. And it's funny how it was always the people who had nothing to do with neurodiversity who would get, and it wasn't many people got offended, but I sometimes get people going, I can't believe you're like doing a whole show taking the piss out of your son when he's autistic. And I'd be like, well, it's not taking the piss.
Yeah.
It's celebratory. And people who are autistic like it. So, and I would sometimes say, well, what's your link to, do you have a link to this? Well, no, but you just shouldn't be talking about that stuff. Like it's not yours to talk about. And I would think, no, my relationship with my autistic son is absolutely mine to talk about. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm not claiming to be autistic. And so it's funny, isn't it? People just hear the word autism and they think, oh, are you, and you're doing a comedy show about autism. It's like, no, I'm doing a comedy show about my relationship with my son, who's autistic. Yeah. Different. So people do get a bit aerated, don't they?
Well, it's things. Often people that haven't had any experience of those things. I think I find
comedy or autism.
Well, about all number of subjects. It's generally people that have no kind of conscious kind of learning of it or knowledge of that experience. And
they hear the word.
Yeah, they hear the word.
They've heard the word and they're like, oh, you said autism, you shouldn't have said that. And you're like, well, just listen to the end of the gag and you'll see where it goes.
I mean, I know that was, I don't know if they were in person or social.
Yeah, I did have some in person once. People really? Come to the show. You know, when you get random people turn up in Edinburgh who you've usually flyered in, thinking, I don't care what you look like or how you seem, just come in. And then they're the person who fucks the whole show up. You're like,
Fuck. I had that with a gig in London once with a magician friend of mine, Dee Riley. I don't know if you have a gig with him. Great. Like, I don't know if he's still doing magic anymore. And they were flying people on the street to get him in, and that no one had turned up. There was like four people in the audience. In the end, they were just cajoling people on the street, come in, it's free, you haven't got to pay, whatever, come in. This big group came in of about seven or eight, I don't know if it was a Hindu or not, but anyway, it was ladies drinking, and they just, I think they're the only ones that didn't pay, and they fucked up the entire night. And it was just like, it became the them show, basically.
It's awful when that happens, isn't it? And then you feel, because we're so desperate for audience.
Yeah.
You're like, I should have. Yeah. Although I will say, you don't always know, do you, when you're flying? You can't always see the train wreck coming. Like, it can be the most innocuous of people. You're like, oh, I really wish they hadn't come in. So,
yeah, it would have been better to just do to the four. Like, it would have been absolutely fine. But then, I don't know. It's not your fault, is it? It's just the way it goes. And it's just, and then you just have to negotiate it on for the gig, and I ended up doing zero material that night, absolutely none. And just,
it's just crowd control. It's like being on an open top bus with a hen party on board, and you're just like, right, I'll just try and say some things and get the bus around the city, and then I'll try
stop being sick over the side, please.
Exactly. And I'll try and get to the pub as quickly as I can to catch up remotely with where you guys were for the whole of my working night.
Exactly.
I don't mind a heckler now. I think that's one of the things I like. I do quite a lot of the kind of rougher clubs. I do the boat show a lot on the Tattersall Castle. That can be quite a rowdy one. I like nothing more than taking down a heckler on that boat. Down, I don't know why it's that boat. I think because it gets really light in your face and quite laddie, and I'm always like, come on then, guys, let's do this. I don't like it. I don't know why. Something wrong with me.
No, that's good. So you enjoy, because a lot of comedians, I have to admit, I'm not particularly keen on taking on hecklers, but you quite enjoy that.
I don't like apathy. I'll take a heckler over apathy. I don't like anyone asleep in my audience. Call me old fashioned. That's annoying. Someone awake is good starting point, and then if they can speak, that's good. But do you know what I think it is? Is what you realise, emceeing and as a comic, is everybody wants the heckler taken down. Yeah. Usually, even their mates do.
Yeah.
Often, especially their mates do, because they're like, if you don't shut the fuck up, we're getting thrown out. So shut up, gang.
People, that's part of it, isn't it? Like, people kind of do that to get, to almost like kind of say, hey, boys, look, like, I'm going to be the one that sort of makes a fool of themselves to upset.
And nobody wants, it is that. The room wants them to get taken down, and the room doesn't all feel like the heckler feels about you. It's easy for heckler to say something horrible. You know, don't give up the day job. Well, you're not funny, love. Women aren't funny. The whole room isn't thinking that. The whole room is thinking, why did that dickhead just say that? And then if you remember that, then all you're trying to do is get the room hunting as a pack against the heckler. So you just need to say something which the room goes on board with you, makes the heckler know they're on your side, and then you've dealt with it. I do also think perhaps those kind of more silverback heckles where someone's trying to be the alpha in the room, it probably has a bit of a different dynamic with me at the helm, and probably they're going to really look like a dick if I take them on, they really beat their chest. Everyone's going to be like, what on earth do you think you're doing? So I think possibly if it might escalate with chest beating, it does a bit less. But also I try and do it in a way that makes them feel all right. I don't try and really annihilate them. I just try and make them know that everyone's paid good just, money not to hear them.
Yeah, just be quiet.
Silverback heckles, a lovely, lovely way of putting it.
Yeah.
Have you had any where you've had to like chuck anyone out or get anyone removed?
Definitely been at gigs where people have been chucked out. Yeah, and but I really hate it. I always feel like I failed if that happens. There are a couple of those gigs. I mean, Comedy Store will just take people out at a certain point because they don't want it ruining the night. Yeah. The Tattersall Castle have security. There are a few that will, and nowadays Top Secret has a kind of, you'll know what the cards would be, Jim, but as you know, I'm not very good at football, but you get a certain coloured card and then you get a certain other coloured card. And the second card is you end up getting put behind Perspex to watch through, it's not soundproof, but to watch from the back of the room where you can hear the comedy, but they can't hear you anymore. By the bar, and then the third card, you're out of the club.
Fucking hell. I bet some cards? People actually, there's two, yellow and red, and then
maybe you just get two, maybe you get a warning, then one card, then another card. I might have made up the first cards.
I didn't know about the Perspex thing. I wonder if some people that always becomes like a badge of honor, like, can I get in the Perspex?
Yeah, like Mr. and Mrs. get in the Perspex. that's a reference for your younger viewers, listeners, people, humans.
Oh man.
Sorry, go on, Jim.
Just really quickly, I saw a video once of someone at Top Secret. I think it was Top Secret. And I can't remember his name. He's a guy who used to MC a lot, a really nice guy. I can't remember his name. That's so embarrassing. But he put out a little clip on his Twitter and someone threw a pint at him. I think he was like half stripping on stage because he was like taking the piss out of the guy or something. And he threw a pint and it like missed his head by about.
So, presumably, including the glass, not just the liquids.
No, the glass. Yeah, sorry.
The glass. Yeah. No, I mean, even the liquid wouldn't be fun. Wow.
No. Yeah. I can't remember who that was. It's really embarrassing.
I think anything that actually, you do hear, don't you, sometimes of people like physically getting, like I've heard quite a few MCs say there've been times when they physically felt at risk at someone. And I do think, again, probably it's less likely. I've never thought a bloke's going to come and punch me. I've seen blokes look at me like they would very much like to, but I've never, and I've sometimes said, I can see that Colin would really like to punch me right now if I was the same gender and age as him. And they think he probably would, but I think probably, it's horrible though, isn't it? When you think the risk, you definitely hit, people do put up with some real shit on stage, don't they, that they shouldn't have to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. When you're just there to do your
thing,
your
job, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. There's always that classic, you know, do I come and shout at you doing your job in IT? But I tried not to resort to that one. I do sometimes do like a referendum. I'll say someone came in really quick off the mark at the boat show the other night. I literally hadn't even said, hey, welcome to the boat show. And this guy shouted like, whatever, show us your tits or something. I was like, oh, you came in early. I said, right, just wait a minute, sir. Let me just open the night. And then he did another stupid thing. I said, right, let's just get this out of the way. I said, what is your name? And he said, and I said, who are you here with? And it was a stag do. I said, are you the stag? And he was like, no. I said, who is the stag? And whoever it was. And I said, so do you want whatever his name is to totally fuck up your stag do? He's like, no. I said, right. I said, and then he carried on. I said, like, let's just do a quick referendum. Because when we get on, I said, right, by way of a cheer, who has paid 20 quid to hear Colin shouting at me? Nothing. I said, and who's paid to hear the comedy in the whole room? I said, right, so the room's voted. Why don't you shut the fuck up? Not get your stag do straight enough, and oh, we'll do it from here. But that was all within the first.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, 30 just, seconds.
Wow.
He'd probably been plotting that all day. I can't wait to get to the comedy tonight, guys, because I'm going to rip it up.
I know. And then you just think, you literally. Twat. Yeah.
Who actually invited
yeah,
Colin?
He probably wasn't even invited.
I told you not to invite Colin.
The office that no one knows or likes.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Fuck, Colin's coming.
Colin's such a twat. Who invited Colin? Well, he's the brother of the bride. You had to invite him.
He's my cousin's friend. Yeah.
Oh, no, he's my father-in-law.
So yeah, I do think. But actually, I think it's real ammunition as an MC, because if that goes well, the room's so on your side.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's it now. The room's like, we love you.
Yeah.
And you can do anything. So you buy the heckler can buy you a free pass for the night.
Yeah, I suppose it's good to get it out of the way early doors as well, like instead of halfway through or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Own the room. But yeah, just so now I think you do slightly expect it in certain venues, and I kind of slightly like it. But people do sometimes get removed, and then sometimes they'll ask me at the break, they'll be like, Kelly, do you want that group removed, or is it all right from your perspective to keep them in? But I will always try and tell them to shut up for the act. So I will go really hard and say, you know, we've done this, but if you do that when the acts are on, you will be taken out. So because it's not fair on an act trying to actually do proper material to have to deal with that at all.
I wondered, this is sort of strange in comparison, but do you ever feel like for example, if you put out a tweet and someone's horrible about you, which is pretty obvious most of the time that happens, you become more aware of what you're tweeting or what you're saying out loud. Does that ever happen when you're doing a comedy show? Like, are you more aware of thinking, oh God, they're not going to like that next joke that I do? Or that they might kick off again in a minute.
I think, I don't know how it is for you, Jim, with this, but I'm very, on social media, I very rarely had, touch wood, I'm sitting at a wooden kitchen table, very rarely have I had much trolling on social media, but I'm really careful. What I say is authentic, it's not, but I'm very careful about what I will and won't jump into and sort of subject matter I'll go with. So I kind of tread that very, very carefully at the risk averse side, possibly to my detriment sometimes. But the thing that really worries me on stage is not, I will absolutely adapt my, I'll sort of decide, actually, I don't think I should do that bit. Like, I've got bits about Brexit that I realise
Colin would hate
parts of the country. Yeah, but no, but you're just like, oh God, this is all based on the fact you're against it. And if you're in a certain bit of the country, you're like, this ain't going to be funny. Mm. You don't get it, that why I'm thinking it's funny. But I do worry as an MC, because you are thinking so quickly on your feet. I've gone quite close to, obviously I'm inherently, I hope I don't have any opinions that are offensive. I hope I'm a person who's not trying to hide some awful side of myself, but you do sometimes go very close to the line of something that would really not be an okay thing to say because you're trying to be so quick and sharp. And I've had to pull myself back from the brink just in time. So I thought, actually, that could be, you cannot say that to that person who's, you know, visually impaired or whatever. That's not funny. It'll get a laugh, but that's not actually okay. So I've definitely had things where I'm like, oh, don't, your brain's going quickly, but do not say that. And you hope you have the edit button just before it comes out of your mouth. A couple of times I've had to say, I can't think of an example, but I've said afterwards, you know, actually something to kind of caveat it and to say, actually that came out, but actually what I want to say is this, and correct it in the room, because I wouldn't want that person to feel bad, and I don't want to be cancelled. So.
Yeah, we just want to be loved.
Yeah, I think you do have that edit button though. I think like you just by nature of being an empathetic person and good with people, I think you just probably naturally do have that. And normally it's like when your brain, if you like driving, and then I don't know if you guys have this, but you sometimes think of like really horrible things in your head. And like, I can't remember who told us on the podcast, and it's like, that's your brain like pushing the boundaries. So you might think like, I could drive off the road right now, like into a tree, but I won't. But like, that's my brain giving me the boundaries. It's probably the same on stage, where you kind of, you do kind of know how to pull yourself back in just by nature of being a sort of people person, empathetic person?
I think you generally do, but you could, it's a bit like if you're with your mates down the pub and you're feeling very relaxed and you would say something that if someone just took that out of context, yeah, it would sound really bad, but you're doing it as part of a joke and you know your opinion and they know your opinion. So they know that was a dark joke as opposed to I actually think that. Mm. And I think that's the risk, is that bit of you might come out. And it is a really scary thing to think that if that one tiny thing got out of context, we have a duty, don't we, on stage, not to say a thing that might be really unacceptable in any way, even if taken out of context. But that is a bit risky, and I do sometimes think, oh god, I'm not a controversial comedian, and I sort of challenge certain things for certain demographics, but I do worry that my edit button might be sort of marginally after my mouth's opened. I've definitely done it at corporates, like I did a after lunch speech at the Ivy 2 days ago, and I did not take to the people there at all. I hope none of them are listening, but anyway, I could have done 2 speeches at the Ivy this week, so let's assume if they are, it wasn't really. But they were right Tory, but somebody was defending Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock, and I was like, fuck, and this isn't my kind of crew. Anyway, yeah. I was only on stage 20 minutes, and I did twice make jokes about, well, I'm only doing this for the money and I think you're a bunch of dicks type jokes twice. And I could see the first one, they were like, ha, and the second one, they were like, what? that was a bit too, don't actually tell them what you think. I think, and that was an example where I sometimes do it in corporate hosting. I'll go tiny bit over the line.
Yeah, but like,
that was a bit much.
It might, yeah, but at the same time, like, yeah, stuck it to them.
Oh, most of the room will be like, I'm so glad you said that to the CEO. Yeah. And I'm thinking, I really hope this doesn't get back to the CEO.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
I don't mind if you all think it's funny, but I do want to get paid. Yeah.
Did you want to take a quick photo, Jim?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, photo. Yep.
Me in my kitchen. I normally do these in my study.
I was going to say, right at the start, you've moved from location from...
Yeah, puppy-related move. Should I move this out of the way?
Okay, let me double check. I think that's all good.
Is that his job, Jazz?
Yeah.
It's not your only job, but you don't do the photos ever.
No, it's always Jim. He just insists on taking them.
Just don't trust
them,
him. Just don't trust him.
It's such a sort of stereotype marriage. I reckon you should break the rule, change the rules a bit. Keep it spicy.
Shall I do the intro to this one?
I think you should, because I always do the intro, but I think it's because Jim doesn't remember to do the first bit of the intro. I can't remember what the words are. Oh, what is this podcast again? Welcome to the FYP. The football podcast.
That's a long title, to be fair, Jim. It's one word. One word to remember.
It's not in my wheelhouse to remember. No, because Giles has come up with a fancy sort of...
It's not fancy. Say three things. I think you should do it this time, though.
It's a very good, just to mix it encompassing up phrase. But
I know what you could do. You could write down what Giles said and read it out.
Yeah.
I could do, couldn't I?
I'll send it to you in a WhatsApp.
I want to put my own spin on things, you know? I want to be my own man.
Yeah. It's a good idea, but it won't be taken, adopted, unfortunately.
Well, that's really the best creative advice I've given you. Write it down and bloody read it out. Stop mithering.
Right, well, I am going to do it this week anyway. But Giles, we'll have to reconvene and do the topic.
Yeah. Go and have your interview.
Okay.
Enjoy it.
I'll try and fuck this interview up.
Callie, thanks so much. And I watched you. I watched you on QI. Was it last night or the night before? You were fantastic. You came second.
I never watched it.
You were robbed. You were robbed. You should have won it.
I don't know, as long as my hair looks nice and I get...
Your hair looked very nice.
That's all.
Yeah,
and
you get a few lines. Yeah, exactly.
The only comment I ever get is about my bloody hair. I don't know why I bother doing those things. Like, is it a wig? I'm like, no, it's my hair. Did you like any of my jokes? So, thank you. Well, I'm glad you liked it, not for my hair, John.
No, I liked it for your jokes. You were very funny.
His next thing is going to be, and your hair looks great as
well.
Yeah,
exactly.
He's held himself back from
that. And are your teeth real?
Thanks, Callie.
Thank you so much.
Speak soon,
bye.
Guys.
Yeah, bye. Bye.
Well, there you go. Callie Beaton on the Blank Podcast. I mean, I did that bit okay, but obviously before the interview, that was a car crash. I think we need to stick to our roles. Let's never change it up again.
You were very good there, though. That was very smooth. the outro. That was excellent.
Mm.
Yeah. I don't think
not
it's
hard
good to
that bit though, is it?
I think, yeah, you know, no, it's not actually. You're right. It's not. It's just that's actually, and even I still get it wrong sometimes. I think it's good to mix things up sometimes. Keeps everyone on their toes. Keeps the pod fresh. You know.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Sometimes there'll be people listening think, oh, what's happened? I think it came up. This came up on Callie's podcast. So if you go and listen to Callie's Namaste as Fuck podcast, she says, and I think this has been said about us before, that our voices aren't dissimilar enough, really.
Yeah.
So people might not even notice.
That's true. And it's almost the Streisand effect. If you draw attention to it, then people are now thinking about it, but they may not have realized.
Streisand effect.
Do you not know? You not heard about that?
No.
So that is when someone doesn't want something, when you draw attention to something that you didn't want people to notice inadvertently. For example, it comes from when Barbara Streisand had a house in the Hollywood Hills or something, and she tried to, or was doing work on it or something, and she tried to ban photographers from taking photos of this house or this work. But in doing so, that made people more interested.
Yes.
So in the end, more people knew about the house than people she wanted initially.
Right, so interesting.
Draw attention to something inadvertently that you didn't want people to notice. That's the Streisand effect.
Ah, interesting.
Which we've just done with our voices and the intros and all that.
I think they touch. You know what? I've just watched Paul Thomas Anderson's last movie, Licorice Pizza, which was very good, sort of coming of age kind of movie. And there is a sort of subplot in it where the gang of the teenagers that are kind of the protagonist and his girlfriend and some other their sort of gang go and help do some stuff at Barbara Streisand's house, sure there's maybe it's that house that she moved into. I'm sure that there's a big thing about this new house, so it could have been that there they end up trashing it. I think if I remember correctly, but yeah.
Maybe that's why she didn't want to get out.
Anyway, it's a great movie. I'd recommend it. But yeah, that's interesting. I've never heard of it called that. But there is, I mean, I think we all do that to a sense, don't we? There's things that we don't want people to notice or mention.
You sort of accidentally sort of do it anyway. Maybe subconsciously you do want them. Have you read The Secret or heard, you know, the book The Secret?
I know the book very well. I used to work in a bookshop and we used to sell a fair few copies of that thing.
Yeah.
But then they thought of gone these sort of weird Hallmark movies that are based on it, haven't they?
It's all a bit mad.
Yeah.
But that there's a bit in that about that you subconsciously, you do want people to know these things, even though you think you don't. It's all a bit mad. Thanks, Callie, for coming on.
Yeah.
Sorry, we've derailed that big time. Fantastic guest. I mean, you can see why she's done so well with her career in comedy and everything she does. Just a brilliant person.
Mm.
But thanks, you know, she was very honest and open in this episode about some of her imposter syndrome and dating experiences and all that, really. And I think you don't get to know someone unless they are kind of open on these pods. So I really appreciate her doing that. And it's just a joy to talk to her. But I knew it would be.
Yeah, she's lovely. Absolutely lovely person. And yeah, was very candid and honest with us about all sorts of different aspects of her life. And like you say, very, very funny. And it's just great to see her popping up on, you know, shows. I think I mentioned at the end, I watched her on QI the other week and it was just great. It's like, oh, there's Callie on there. You know, really exciting to see her doing so well. So it's fantastic. And wish her all the best for the future.
Absolutely. And you can hear more from Callie in our Patreon version. We've got extra content with all our guests at patreon.com, patreon.com/blankpodcast. It's £2.50 a month to sign up, which is not bad at all, considering you get an episode every week with extra content. So, and you get them 24 hours in advance and you get them with no adverts. I mean, what more could you want?
I know.
For £2.50 a month. So do sign up, because of course, next week, Giles, there'll be another guest on the Blank Podcast.
Yeah, there will. You said it's like, oh, there'll be another guest.
No,
another guest.
We are obviously, like most pods, we are recording and releasing at the same sort of time, and we're only a few weeks behind. We're doing some cracking guests at the moment, really cracking guests. So some really exciting ones.
We're very lucky, aren't we, with the guests we get?
We are. We're very lucky indeed. Yeah, we do. We do all right.
What have we done to have this luck?
Two random guys in their bedrooms. You know what? Bedrooms, my cabin, but you know, two guys in the corner of the. You know,
could you sleep in there though if you had to?
Do you know what? I could actually in the next bit. Yeah, and in fact, actually, there's a sofa bed in there.
Oh, well, there you go.
It's all a mess right now, but it's going to become a... Yeah, so it almost a bedroom, I guess. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
So if I've slept in there, then I've had an argument with my wife. So you'll know. You'll know why. Again, why would I publicize that? Again, Streisand effect. Why would I tell anyone? I'd be sleeping in there, but who knows? The beauties of life. Anyway, I think we should wrap up there. And come back next week. Again, it's your turn now to wrap up the pod. So I'll hand over the reins.
Thank you. If you want to get in touch with us, you can. Our social media handles are
at BlankPod.
And you can get us on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, I think. I mean, do people still use Facebook? Anyway, I think it's a bit old, isn't it? It's for the old fogies. Thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you next week with another episode of the Blank Podcast. Goodbye.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in business into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.